Between the Lines
with Sarah McInerney.
This is News Talk.
Here to discuss with us this week and tell us who's been up and down in politics, we're joined by Alison O'Connor, columnist with the Irish Examiner, and Fergus Finlay, chief executive of Barnardo's and also a former senior political advisor. And thank you both very much for joining us this morning. Thus far this morning, we've been discussing Savita Halpanavra, because it is the fifth anniversary of her death. And at the time, Alison, a lot of people were talking about it as a turning point in Irish history and a turning point in the debate on abortion. Do you think it has turned out to be that turning point?
I do. I mean, I suppose technically when you talk about a turning point, you anticipate that something happens at that point. So I don't know, what is the phrase for a turning point that 5 years on we still haven't turned, but it set us on that course, I think, inexorably. I suppose we'd had the referendum in 2002. It had been fairly quiet subsequent to that. We had then had a judgment which had shown in the European Court of Human Rights politically that something was going to have to be done. And then Savita's tragic death, I think, put it absolutely front and centre. I think Irish people were so incensed by what had happened. And I think also the whole notion of social media, I think, played a big part in somewhere for that anger to go and even to organise vigils. I think that there was the realisation politically that something had to be done. And I think it's been, to use that awful word, a journey sort of since then. It's been the Protection of Life and Pregnancy Act. It's been the Citizens Assembly. It's now the Committee on the Eighth Amendment, which voted last week that indeed, you know, that change was needed. The Taoiseach has committed to a referendum. So by this time next year, something will have changed in relation to our abortion laws. We just don't know what yet.
How do you see it going, Fergus? Because we were speaking just a few minutes ago before we came on air. You were reminiscing about the debate around the time the Eighth Amendment was put into the Constitution and how vicious that got at the time. Do you see it transpiring like that or evolving like that again this time around?
I'm afraid it will be. I should say, first of all, that I work for an organisation which, for a whole variety of reasons and after a lot of debate, has decided not to take a position on the Eighth Amendment. So what I say, you know, is about kind of history and all that. I mean, I'm probably the only one here who was old enough to remember the debate that took place in Doyle Éireann when it was introduced first. It was incredibly bitter and divisive. Padraig Flynn, in that debate, of all people, accused Gara Fitzgerald of having no personal integrity. And it went on in that way for day after day after day. And at the end of that debate, 141 deputies voted in principle for the Eighth Amendment and only 11 voted against it. Those 11 included Tony Gregory, Pronchis de Rossa, Damás McGiulla, and 8 Labour deputies, including Mervyn Taylor, Dick Spring, Barry Desmond and people like that. The 2 Cork deputies, Eileen Desmond and Toddy O'Sullivan, voted throughout against the Eighth. And there were a lot of warnings then about the consequences, a huge number of warnings about the ambiguity of the terms, the fact that it would have no impact and so on. But we still ended up with the most divisive and bitter and vicious campaign I have ever been involved in my life. I think most people who went through it on both sides still carry some of the scars of that debate. The things that were said, the things that were posted to people's homes, the abuse that people got on doorsteps, it was fearsome. Now, I hope we've grown up enough to be able to debate issues like this in a much more calm way. I'm not sure that that is the case. I certainly hope it is. I'm always puzzled, though, when people talk about turning points in Ireland. I mean, the tragedy of Savita Halpanavra, you would think would be some kind of a turning point in any debate. But God, we've had so many turning points in Ireland and nothing ever seems to change. We had the Ryan report. We've had endless reports into terrible things that have happened to children in Ireland. And every time it happens, we say, never again, never again. We're never going to allow this to happen again. And still, these things keep happening. So, you know, I'm really fearful about what's going to happen in the next 6 months, 7 months.
I think it's fascinating to hear. I mean, I think Fergus's, if I may call it this, your institutional memory of that time and what went on is really important to remember that. I think one of the very significant changes, isn't it, is now that we have so much talk about the middle ground. Then it was you were either on one side or you were on the other. And it was so polarised and so vicious that there's now this, you know, that there's this middle ground there. And where will that end up? We don't know what question is going to be put, but where will that end up in any potential referendum campaign? And I think that's an issue that both sides will have to think about very carefully.
I think there was a middle ground then. Like 2/3 of the people of Ireland voted in 1983 in that referendum, and 2/3 of the people who voted voted in favour of the amendment, which is less than a majority of the people. Mm. And I've always believed, because I was on the ground and I remember it and so on, I've always believed that thousands and thousands and thousands of people voted to abstain, if you know what I mean.
Abstain.
Because they just couldn't make up their minds.
But the majority, a hell of a lot more people then would have been afraid to come out and say that they were in favour of abortion.
Yeah,
that's what's changed now.
Nobody came out and said
now you have had people who have publicly come out and said that they've had abortions. You have had the people who have told their tragic stories from terminations for medical reasons. And you have far more people who are willing to come out and say, I support, you know, a woman's right to abortion. Now, there's a spectrum on that, you know, as to some people will just support it in the case of fetal abnormality, rape, others will go. And there's an incredibly well-organised lobby. And it does sort of, with the real Peel the Eighth Coalition, which is a very big grouping, that the politicians must have at the back of their minds. They now have the anti-abortion side, which was always extremely good at campaigning and at putting TDs and senators under pressure.
It's as united today as it was then.
Yeah, you've the Repeal the Eighth side that has really got its act together and is equally putting pressure on. And you have, you know, you have the politicians in the middle of those two sides and also thinking about their constituencies and the vote at the next general election
and
what
the
they're going to do.
But just the point that you made, Alison, about, you know, the middle ground existing now, maybe to an extent that it didn't exist then. I wonder, do you think there's a danger that the middle ground won't be given an opportunity to have their voice heard by virtue of the question that is put to them? That the question that is put to them won't be for the middle ground, it'll be, you know, on the more conservative end, because that's the way politicians are leaning.
I mean, the signals so far, and certainly if you listen to the Taoiseach, and I think a lot of the cabinet ministers, the Fine Gael cabinet ministers, is you are looking at fetal abnormality and rape, basically. Yeah. And
which,
you know,
has been identified in the last couple of weeks in committee as affecting about 6% of the women who have abortions.
But what's interesting
in this
for me, right, is, and I'm writing about this in the exam this morning, and I wrote about it in my lot of writing about abortion this week yesterday. What's interesting for me, having observed all of the Citizens' Assembly and now watching the committee on the 8th, you can see a similar thing happening with the committee, whereby they are listening to their chosen very good witnesses, medical experts, all of that. They're getting all of the information. They're asking a lot of interesting questions. They're hearing a lot of things they didn't know before, that they didn't understand. And you can see they're getting caught up in it, and that some of them may be even having their minds changed, right? Which was a similar process. But the problem is that, and to use that awful word that I used earlier again, journey, the rest of, no more than the judge, you're 99 citizens and not the rest of the country. Now you have your members of the committee, I think it's 22, isn't it? Mm. And you don't have the rest of Leinster House. So I don't know how that is going to, again, how that's going to equate, that if you have, we'd say, from government pushing for quite conservative, the, you know, members of the committee possibly wanting more. But it's also up in the air. It's very, very difficult
to predict
where
you need,
it'll go.
And I'm going to move on from this in a second, Fergus, but is that where you need leadership then, from what Alison's saying? So you have small groups of people, the 99 Citizens Assembly, the 22 members of the committee, sitting down and getting intensive education, I suppose, from medical legal experts as to what the Eighth Amendment means. But the rest of the country and the rest of the Dáil is still where it was, you know, 6 to 9 months ago.
Well, I'm not 100% sure that that's the case. I mean, I follow the Citizens Assembly and I was really impressed by, you know, the clarity of a lot of the discussion, the sincerity of a lot of the discussion. But I was also impressed by the number of people I met who were also following it and taking it seriously. I've been trying to follow the committee and, you know, by and large, and I don't want to get into personalities, but by and large, the work has been really intense, really thorough, really serious. You can see people thinking through positions and asking serious questions and so on. And I suspect there's an awful lot of people watching that. I mean, I think...
I'm not sure about ordinary people, just how much attention they're paying to it. I don't know.
I think what you'll find, and I mean, my hope, whatever happens, my hope is that there is a kind of a civilised debate and a rational debate. I think what you'll find is that more people are going to come into this debate better informed than they ever were before.
It's seeping in, one way or another.
I think it is seeping in. The pros and the cons are seeping in. And, I mean, I have endless discussions with daughters, with colleagues and so on about the pros and cons of the issue. And I'm amazed at how... Now, maybe it's because I'm old and, you know, have a
Fergus,
particular...
You're not that old.
I have a...
Older.
When you think about, you know, like, I can remember some of this stuff as if it was yesterday, but it was actually 35 years ago. And when you think back to that and then you, like, everyone had an opinion then. Nobody knew anything. Now, I think everyone still has an opinion, but an awful lot of people know an awful lot more.
One of the
and
things,
I think we are going to have a more informed debate.
One of the things that's fascinating to watch in terms of what people have learned, the start of the Citizens' Assembly, and you see it right through, is about the abortion pill, okay? Which is actually two pills. And we'll say they've just agreed that in Scotland women will be able to take it at home. And a big study published by the British Medical Journal last year showed that out of 1,000 Irish women, 90% had no problem whatsoever. Some needed, of the 10%, some needed antibiotics, some needed a blood transfusion. So it's a possible, it's not a perfect solution. Possible solution for the committee would be to recommend the legalisation of the abortion pill. You then wouldn't have, I think a lot of Irish people feel quite upset at the notion of abortion, the infrastructure of abortion being built around the place.
And surgical abortions
in surgical
taking place.
And surgical, exactly. And for want of a better word, a squeamishness about that. So it would be an it would be an Irish solution, you know, that you do that. But you'd obviously also then have to do something for fetal abnormalities. But I think it's a very interesting possible solution. At the moment already, I reckon there's probably between 1,000 and 1,500 abortions happening in Ireland every day, under our noses, as it were, through the abortion pill, which is being brought in illegally. So it's already happening, and I think that number is going to keep increasing.
I want to talk, Fergus, about the banks and the tracker mortgages and a scandal, I think, that is going to keep on running and keep on running over the next couple of months and right into next year now by the looks of it. How do you think the government has approached it? Because they've had a lot of criticism this week for how they've approached it. But I have to say, I've been watching them and thinking, you know, they gave this job to the central bank. The central bank didn't do a good job, and maybe the government didn't come down on them hard enough, soon enough, in terms of not doing a good job. But ultimately, is this not the central bank's fault?
I think ultimately it's the bank's fault. I think this is a conspiracy. You know, nobody can allege cartel without proof. But this most extraordinary thing where all the banks decided to screw their customers on more or less on the same day, in the same way, at the same time, and treated people the most appalling fashion. Like, this was a disgusting conspiracy, which the central bank and the government were really, really slow to get on top of. My own view, for what it's worth, is that I think Pascal Donoghue has done a really good job in the course of the week. He's forced the banks out into the open, not sufficiently out into the open, but he's forced them out into the open. He's forced them to set out timelines around which they will begin to act. But there's a certain side of me, though, that thinks that this reminds me a little bit of the Christian Brothers and some of the religious orders after the Ryan report, where they all issued these apologies on air, but kept their legal teams to their right-hand side while they were doing it. And I suspect the banks are in exactly the same position. We've hired a PR company to write an apology for us, but the PR companies, every utterance of the PR company will be lawyered up and managed and so on. And woe betide any customer who decides, I can go further. They will feel the full might of the law. And, you know, like the fact that customers, and this is almost unique now in Ireland, the fact that customers have to go on their own up against the banks, strikes me as part of the scandal.
In that vein of comparison to the Christian Brothers, Alison, is that part of the problem? And like, is there a collective public deference to the banks that we can't seem to get out of our heads, that they are these big institutions that ultimately know best?
No,
or?
I don't think so. I think certainly post the crash, Irish people do not. The ordinary Irish person does not feel like that about the banks. But I think everybody is quite stunned that the banks, despite all that went on, have still managed to hang on to this extraordinary arrogance and this notion that they can treat people like that. There's obviously zero fear in senior banking circles about repercussions. And while, as Fergus said, you could see the government, you know, attempting to do, you know, what they could about this, Pascal Donoghue, you're left with the impression that they're going to be dragged kicking and screaming the entire and hanging on to their money for dear life. And I doubt very much that the ordinary Irish person has much confidence after what's happened after the last few weeks that this thing will be within a reasonable time frame that this thing will be sorted
out. Is personal accountability the way to go? Fianna Fáil suggesting if you make bankers literally personally responsible for their actions that this could change.
Well, I mean,
this
is the wider issue, isn't it? You're talking about the Christian Brother. This issue of is anyone made responsible for anything in Ireland? This is another very, very good example of that, and that you can operate really without any sense of fear that there will be a repercussion. Mm.
I mean, we're not far away from the 10th anniversary of the bank guarantee and then the crash and then the blame game. And, you know, the banks just marched unscathed through it. We have now put billions. We've mortgaged the future of generations to help them recover their balance sheet. And apparently they're not willing to part with the petty cash that would be necessary, in their terms, the petty cash that would be necessary to do justice to people that they have treated absolutely shamefully. I mean, if there was a way of firing the lot of them, they should be fired. Senior managers, boards should be taken out.
Why not do that?
I don't know why not. I've never understood since this crisis started why, apart from a couple of failed prosecutions, nobody in banking circles has been asked to take any responsibility whatsoever for the way they brought the country to its knees. And now in their recovery, the way they are still continuing to treat customers.
Mm. All right, I want to move on to another story that has also been provoking a lot of debate this week, Alison, and that's the story of Tom Humphreys and the sentence that he got for the sexual abuse of a child over a long period of time, 2.5 years. A lot of people throwing up their hands saying, what message does this send out? A very interesting article in the Irish Times yesterday from Ian O'Donnell, who's professor of criminology in UCD, and he talked about how the public don't understand sentencing and how sentences are brought about and that they need to be educated on that. But he said sentencing ought to have an educative function. The public should know that a measured response has been taken in their name. Offenders should know that their treatment is not arbitrary, and victims should know that the harm that they suffered was taken seriously. And I actually think on all those measures, the Tom Humphreys sentencing doesn't reach.
You took the words out of my mouth as you read. I didn't read that yesterday, but as you read those out, that's exactly my reaction. And what it comes down to really was a quote from Nolene Blackwell from the Rape Crisis Centre, where she said, like, really what has to be at the forefront here is what's the value put on childhood and a childhood being ruined? And that's what I think what you have to put next to all of those things that you just read out there. I mean, as I understand it, Tom Humphreys will serve something like 1 year and 7 months, somewhere in and around that. And I don't think anyone would say that that is a proper amount of time. Now, I'm not in the, you know, lock him up and throw away the key paedophiles lobby. I don't think it serves anyone. I think if somebody like Tom Humphreys comes out of prison without having done any, I mean, there's a very high recidivist rate with paedophilia, but if he comes out of prison without having done any sort of course or training, with where he's socially isolated, where, you know, nobody talks to him, all of that, somebody like that, just you're increasing the chance that they will reoffend. That does society absolutely no favours. But I really do, I think even the what happened in the court, the remarks by the judge in terms of how far he'd fallen, it smacked far too much of, whether she meant this or not, of sort of a middle class over-empathising. Mm. And that all of those things to me were actually factors that made it worse. Because I'm kind of, my kids play GAA, and I'm imagining someone, I worked with Tom Humphreys. I mean, I didn't know him, but you'd share the lift with him in the Irish Times building. I always found he'd say hello, but was never sort of overtly friendly. And we thought he was God. I was a young reporter then. I mean, he was amazing, you know, so talented, such a gifted writer. If he turned to somebody like that, turned up at the GAA club, you know, it would be absolute open arms. So you could see exactly how. Now, a lot has changed now with child protection and all of that. So to me, all of those factors meant that it made it easier for him to do what he did, yeah. You know.
Fergus, does it send out a message to child abusers right now or potential child abusers that, you know, we don't take this crime that seriously?
Well, I think people in Ireland and people who want to do harm already know that children in Ireland are not well enough protected, and that children don't matter as much as other people. And I think the sentence in this case was just another one of those messages. Like, we have a long, long history in Ireland of, you know, moving child abusers from one parish to another, yeah. Of protecting institutions rather than protecting children, of forcing children to sign confidentiality agreements, and all of that kind of stuff has been going on and on and on. And we keep saying it's different now, we've changed now. And then we find, you know, that child abusers can actually be treated pretty bloody leniently by the courts. I mean, there's a couple of really interesting things. We've actually now changed the law around all this. There's a piece of legislation in place now which dates from this year and which wouldn't have been relevant in the Humphreys case. But if you use a mobile phone now to groom a child for the purposes of sexual abuse, that carries a sentence of 14 years now. And so we have changed the law. We haven't changed the practice. And we haven't changed attitudes. When you look at the facts of this particular case, and you know, you can extrapolate too much from one case, This was a little girl whose life was taken over by her mobile phone. She was getting thousands and thousands and thousands of messages.
That poor child.
And they were all leading in a particular direction. Mm. They started in one way, and you can see the manipulative trend in the way in which the messages were developing. I'm sure there are parents all over the place really wondering, what can I do? All you can do is make sure that your child understands that the contract around the phone includes your right to access it whenever and however you wish. I'm always inclined to say to parents, don't say no to your child. Say, yes, I will give you a phone when you're 12. And let them understand and accept that they have to wait 2 years, 3 years, whatever it is. And kids actually adapt to that very well. I know I'm going to get one, but I'm not getting one yet.
All right, just finally then, I want to talk about, speaking of children and how we treat children in this country, Fergus, the homelessness figures again out last week showing that the number of children who are homeless and becoming homeless is increasing again. Is this something that we are going to look back on, you know, as our own scandal of this decade? Is this our own personal scandal that we're watching unfold in front of our country?
No doubt about that. And it's particularly a scandal because, I mean, and you know, organisations like Focus Ireland and the Peter McVerry Trust are working with this day in and day out. We would, in Bernardo's, we would work with a couple of hundred kids now whose lives are affected by homelessness. And, you know, we're not a frontline agency in the homelessness sector, but we see the damage that's being caused. And it's absolutely scandalous. Sooner or later, the government is going to decide that it has to change the law, that it has to introduce CPO requirements, that it has to begin taking over property. You walk all the time. I walked down South Circular Road the other day. There's a derelict factory called the Player Wales Factory. I have no idea who owns it. But it's
I live quite near there. There's been more. The devil and all is going to happen there, and it never has.
It's been derelict for years and years and years. I cannot understand. And it's a site where you could easily house 300 to 500 families. It's a huge site. Cannot understand why, as one example, the state hasn't said, we're having that. That's going into the ownership of Dublin County Council. It's being raised, and we're building on that site. All along that road where you live, there are dozens of boarded up local authority houses. It makes no sense whatsoever.
So I'll give the final word to you on this, because I don't believe the government doesn't care about this. I don't believe Owen Murphy doesn't care that there are homeless children under his watch. So why not take the action, as Fergus is saying, whether it's CPO? I know it seems dramatic, particularly from a Fine Gael ideological perspective, to start going down that route. Why not do it, though, in this time of crisis?
You know, I mean, I think when you think how long this is going on now, they had a legitimate reason to say that they were so caught up with austerity and trying to sort that out, they didn't notice them, that anyway, if they'd said back then, we have to build houses, people would have said, you're off your rocker. Okay, that's fair enough. But I mean, how many years have passed since then? And you've had so many ministers, is it 5 ministers in 5 years or something like that? So it shows an extraordinary failure of politics, really, an extraordinary failure on the part of Fine Gael specifically. And that I think that they may now finally have gotten over these ideological issues. But they will, I mean, I do think that the next time they face the electorate at a general election, that they are so vulnerable on this. I mean,
do people care about homeless children apart from to tut-tut and say that's terrible?
I think that people actually do. I think people are quite ashamed to live in a society. I think that it's when they see things on the TV or hear things on the radio, they're not comfortable about living in a society where that happens.
All right, Alison, I'll leave that final word to you. My thanks to Alison O'Connor and Fergus Finlay for joining me this morning.
Between the Lines on News Talk.